couple of things. To begin with, as I may or may not have said last time, I routinely record lectures except when I record classes except when I forget to. So if any of you are uncomfortable with the possibility that your questions might end up on the web someday, tell me and I'll figure out what to do about it. But short of that, I just do it. That way, if you are sick and miss a class, you get to listen to it. If you are reviewing and want to go over a class again, you can do it. And if you live 1,000 miles from here and would like to sit in on this class for free, you can do that too. I've held for a long time that the internet is only a so-so technology for selling information, but it's just wonderful technology for giving information away. Therefore, I try to use it that way. I thought I would start by saying if you had any questions about the course, then do a quick review of what I did last time in terms of mechanics, then talk about some of the general issues, the sort of stuff I discussed in Chapter 2 about how technology affects the world and the legal system, and then maybe go on to talk about encryption if we have time left after talking about everything else. Please note that since in this course you have a book that was written in the process of teaching this course, a large fraction of what I have to say you have already read, and I therefore depend on you people to add some new and interesting things to what we're doing. So to begin with, any questions? Yes? No? Maybe? All right. So the mechanics are pretty simple. On Wednesday, we discuss the technology. On Saturday, you are supposed to email me. Some of you are supposed to email me issues that technology will raise, especially legal issues that technology will raise. Someone in the other seminar asked when Saturday ends, and the answer is midnight, since I expect to get stuff by email, and I'm rarely asleep at midnight. That your issues will typically be something between a sentence and a paragraph. You can see sample issues that are already up if you look at the webpage. You ought to have, what, I suppose, 3 to 5 kind of number, some reasonable number of interesting ideas. And you reserve your technologies in advance. That is, sometime in the next week or two, you ought to figure out at least what's the first chapter that you want to do comments on and tell me so by email, because I don't want to have 12 people talking about one subject and nobody talking about another. I'll try to sort of do first come, first served, and if there are already several people on one chapter, I will suggest you do something else. On each Monday, we then discuss the issues that have been webbed the previous Saturday night by the other students, and we then go on to do another technology on the next Wednesday. That's the basic theory of what we're doing. And in addition to that, you're supposed to, since this is supposed to be a law school, you're supposed to do research on relevant law to some one of the chapters where you think you can say interesting things. And you should take a look at the bottom of the issues page for each chapter that's on the web page. I've got links to research that's been done before, and you should try to find something that hasn't been done before. The big part of the course, however, is your paper. And the paper ought to be some issue or group of issues that are raised by some new technology, normally one that was not discussed in class. Now, if you can take one of the technologies we discussed, but you have a completely new set of issues it raises, that's fine too. If you have ideas about technological revolutions comparable to the ones I'm discussing that I've left out, please tell me, because someday I might want to revise the book or want to add new stuff to the chapter, to the course, or whatever. In addition, since all of us have access to the internet nowadays, and many of us randomly browse it looking for interesting stuff, when you find interesting stuff relevant to this course, send me a link. So if you see a news story about some neat technology that you think we ought to discuss, send me a link and I will put it up on the webpage and other people can find it. And that's how it's expect to work. Questions? No questions. What a simple day we're having. All right. So what are the effects of technology relevant to the law and the world? And the first big change is that it changes what we can do at what cost. And let me start with a story that I noticed is not in the book, though it's in other places. And that's the story of how you have copyright without copyright law. Does anybody know at the beginning of the 20th century, in 1900, well, you may know that 30 years ago, the great pirate nation of the world was Taiwan. Piracy not in the wet sense, but in the published sense, because Taiwan was not a party to the international copyright agreements, and if you went to Taiwan, you could get cheap copies of lots and lots of books at very low prices. What country was in that situation in 1900? What was the country in 1900 which did not respect other people's copyrights?
The
U.S., correct. The U.S. had not signed a copyright treaty with Britain, and it was perfectly legal to pirate British works in the U.S. The interesting thing, however, is that despite that fact, British authors often made more money out of U.S. sales than out of British sales. All right. Why? Because with the technology of 1900, there was a big first-mover advantage in printing. That printing meant hand-setting lead type, which took time and labor, and then physically producing the books and transporting them, presumably by horse-drawn wagon or the equivalent. And so the normal procedure, if you were a British author, was that you provided your American publisher with the text of the book before it came out in England. Long enough before so that by the time the book was published in England, your American publisher had a warehouse full of copies ready to go. And that meant that the first sales were his, because a pirate in America, although pirating is perfectly legal, would have to first duplicate the cost of setting all that type and then lose the first 3 weeks or month sale, however long it took to set the type, print the thing up, and distribute it. And typically for new books, the first month sale is quite a large part of the total sale. Furthermore, if someone did bring out a pirate copy, the publishers would bring out what they called a fighting edition. And a fighting edition was a very cheap, low-cost edition designed to hold the price of the book low enough so that the pirate would never recover the fixed costs of his typesetting. The original publisher had already done the typesetting. He paid for it with luck from his early sales, and he could therefore make it unprofitable to pirate. And the net result of these things was that the U.S., with no copyright law, was nonetheless doing the work of copyright law, that is, arranging for authors to get compensated for their writing, which is sort of an interesting parable almost, because we are now in the opposite situation. This has probably occurred to many of us. We are now in a situation where with copyright law, you can't do the work of copyright law, at least in many areas, because it's becoming increasingly hard to enforce copyrights given the existence of e-books and music downloads and all the rest of that. So that sort of is a nice way, I think, of making the point that the technology changes what you can do and what it costs to do it. And it can change it in either direction, though usually it makes things less expensive. And I would then argue that the tempting view from a legal standpoint, say you enforce the law, there it is, but the right answer is not that, that we don't enforce lots of laws, namely laws that are more trouble to enforce than they're worth. I don't know if any of you have ever looked at a speedometer when you're driving, but if you do, you will conclude that you live in a nation of criminals, because an awful lot of highways, an awful lot of the time, if you are driving at 5 miles above the speed limit, you are being passed by a lot of cars. All right? So we don't choose to enforce that law strictly. We choose to enforce it in extreme cases, essentially, for people driving very fast. And you can think of a whole lot of other cases, either where if you could costly enforce something, it would be the law, but it isn't because you can't, or in which we don't, in fact, enforce rules very strictly because it's too hard to do it. So the right question to ask, in my view, is always not how do we enforce the law, but how do we best achieve its purposes. And if the purpose of the law is to see that authors get compensated, you ask what set of legal rules under the new technology will do the best job of getting authors compensated, not what ones will enforce the existing copyright law. And similarly in lots of other cases. Let me take the case of copyright law for a moment. That's been the case where technology has been most obviously creating problems for people in the last 10 or 15 years with music and to some extent with other things, and ask what are the ways in which you could enforce it in a modern world. And one tempting idea, which turned out to have very serious problems, still being used to varying degrees as technological protection. You find some way of making it impractical to copy the work. And the problem with technological protection is what's referred to as the analog hole. The analog hole is, let us suppose that I put out my music, my beautiful song, with all sorts of very snazzy encryption technology. And if you want to play my song, you've got to send me a dollar and I will send you the key that will unlock the crypto box, the program that's got my song in it, to play it once. What happens thereafter? What do you do during the one time that you were playing the song you paid $1 for? You turn on on the tape recorder, right? Or nowadays, if you're a good geek, you figure out how to feed the information that's supposed to be going to your speakers back into your computer to be turned into a digital file. That's right. That's the analog hole. The analog hole is that any piece of intellectual property that is fully revealed on one use cannot be technologically protected. All right? You can make it less convenient, and many of the practical solutions to these problems really involve things that don't work but work well enough. For example, if you had to literally play it into a tape recorder, the quality wouldn't be as good. So if instead of a dollar it's 10 cents, you don't bother. And maybe 10 cents might well be enough for the publisher if every time you played the song you had to pay them 10 cents. But in principle, at least, you can't do it. The interesting point, though, is that there is a subset of intellectual property for which you can do it. And that consists of all intellectual property that is not fully revealed on one use. And the example that originally occurred to me was a hypothetical one. I was thinking, well, suppose you're Consumer Reports and you'd like to sell advice to people. If you publish a book, as they do, people can copy it. But what if instead people send you queries and you send an answer, which is an answer not about what's the best car to buy, but what's the best car to buy if you want a minivan, don't want to pay more than $29,000, have the following constraints, don't like automatic power doors, some list of what you want. And they will then send you an expert report on that, and it's of no use to your next door neighbor because your next door neighbor has a different set of requirements. And it then occurred to me that while Consumer Reports doesn't operate this way, there is a very large and commercially successful enterprise which everybody in this room is familiar with, and probably many of you have used, which does operate this way. That's the Westlaw and Lexis model. That Westlaw and Lexis are not giving you a download of their database, they're giving you the result of a search. And since most of the time the person next to you in the law office doesn't want the result of your search, he wants the result of a different search, consequently, they can sell access to their database without ever actually losing the database. If that makes sense. And then I would, yeah?
I'm having a hard time following that because I feel as though, and this is just speaking from personal experience, general observation, that when people want to copy something illegally, they're usually looking for it. So it's not that they want a database.
Yeah.
They want one song.
Yes.
So when you mention the idea of just giving part of it, I'm thinking like when you go on the Amazon and ask, okay, we'll let you see the table of contents, we won't let you see the whole book.
Except that once you buy the book, in the case of Amazon, you could then make copies for all your friends.
Okay.
And if you were doing it in a sufficiently sophisticated way, you could put those copies up on a web page, preferably hosted in some country that doesn't have strong opinions on intellectual property. And if we had good electronic cash, as hopefully we will at some point, you could then sell other people's intellectual property for 10 cents on the dollar. That's the model I'm thinking of, basically. And this is really, to some extent, getting into what we're going to be doing next week on encryption, is in a world where you can't literally enforce copyright law, which is what we're gradually moving towards, I'm arguing, because of the ease of copying and transmitting. In that world, what are the ways in which the creators of intellectual property can get paid? That's the question I'm asking. What I'm saying is that in that world, for those forms of intellectual property fully revealed on one use, which would apply to a book or a song, the option of technological protection ultimately doesn't work. It can make it less convenient, it can make it harder, but once one person has got it out of the protection, as it were, by playing it, he can now make copies for everybody else. And the process is slowed by the fact that what you want is probably not the same book your friend next door has, but with the internet we've got solutions to that problem. And the solutions were found for music a few years ago and got into various problems. You can find ways of making it possible to search for what you want from lots of different people or from a pirate database somewhere that they offshore and then download it. So the point I'm trying to make at the moment is that there are really... That forms of technological protection, keeping physical control over it, as it were, only work if you're never giving a full copy. And that works for Lexis and Westlaw. Now, you could imagine a sufficiently large-scale effort, think of it as an open-source illegal project, where everybody who downloads anything from Lexis then sends it to a repository somewhere, and it gradually rebuilds the Lexis database. But that's going to be a much, much slower process than pirating a book or pirating a song. All right, make sense? So I was sort of trying to think as sort of science fiction-y type person, how could you create other forms of intellectual property when it could be protected in the same way? And I said, well, what if you had a movie in which instead of one version of the movie, as you watched the movie, you could choose which camera to look out of, which part of the scene to be seeing, which character's eyes to look for. Wouldn't that be an interesting sort of more sophisticated art form than existing movies? But then that would be one where each time you did it, it would be different, and thus the producer could keep control over it. And it then occurred to me, wait a minute, I've been wasting hours a week on this project, consuming this product for a couple of years, because that's World of Warcraft. All right, what is World of Warcraft? It is a story which is different to everybody who reads it. And it is perfectly straightforward. I think Blizzard even sets up, if I remember correctly, within the program, the technology for recording your adventure. And if they don't, it exists because there are lots of recorded adventures up on the web. So you can play World of Warcraft for an hour or two, defeat some powerful boss, film the whole thing, and no one is going to be interested because what everybody wants to do is to defeat the boss themselves in their own adventure. All right. So that, it turns out, was quite an interesting example where you have two almost directly competing forms of entertainment, films and games, and yet one of them is protectable and one of them isn't. All right. An ordinary computer game is not protectable because you download the whole thing to your computer. But World of Warcraft is sitting up on Blizzard servers. You're only downloading part of it to your computer, and therefore you can't sell other people, at least can't very successfully sell other people, access to the game, although you could sell copies of your game. Make sense? Yes? No? All right. So that's an interesting initial distinction. Just think about the problem of the objective isn't enforcing copyright law. The objective is making it profitable to produce intellectual property that people value. And there may be a bunch of different solutions to that problem. There always have been a bunch of different solutions to that problem. How was it done? Here's an interesting question. How did authors get paid for writing books a few centuries back? Anybody know? Copyright law comes in Britain with the Statute of Anne, which is in 17-something or other, if I remember correctly. So before then, how did authors get paid? Anybody know? If you happen to read old books, perhaps an odd thing to do, you will quite often notice something very strange about them, and that is that the first two pages of the book are an effusive paean of praise to some nobleman you've never heard of. All right, he's the most intelligent, wise, virtuous, not to mention generous person anybody's ever met. Who do you think has been feeding the author for the last 3 years? All right, so one traditional solution to this problem is patronage. Is that you get somebody to pay you in exchange for your promoting him, in effect. Suppose we wanted to do that in the modern world. Suppose you have a popular band, and you say to yourself, this piracy is just too much of a pain. I'd like to get paid for making songs. I can try to get people to give me 10 cents a song or something, but I'd like more than that. Who might you want to go to? Yep.
Advertisers, like in the sports industry, you know, making money playing Senate, but
endorsements. That's right. And the example, I wasn't thinking of that example, but I was thinking that you go to Apple Computer or to some other company, preferably to a company whose customers are the kind of people who like the music you write. And you say, I'd like to bring out a new CD. And I'd like this CD to be entitled, Thank You, Apple. And I have a little bit of text at the beginning talking about how nice it is, was work, being helped by Apple, having them support my work, and so forth and so on. And if you don't mind, $100,000, please. So that would be one example of a way in which, for the kinds of intellectual property you can enforce copyright law, how you might get paid, how people historically have gotten paid, and as you say, how sports figures now get paid. And in a sense, it's not that far from the way radio and television are now produced, because after all, one of the features of radio and television, absent cable, the old form of radio and television, was you couldn't control who listened to it. You therefore couldn't charge for the product itself, but what you could do is charge by having attached to that product advertisements that people would pay you to put on. All right, so that's, it seems to be an interesting example. Yeah? I understand. What you're saying is that we now have a technology where that solution works less well. Given that technology, let us suppose you're right. Suppose you believe that more and more people will be able, for almost no trouble at all, to fast forward over all the ads. What would be the next step? What would you're Coca-Cola, and you say, we've been paying these popular programs lots of money to put ads for Coca-Cola, and nobody's watching them. What would you, as Coca-Cola's advertising manager, think about doing next? Have the hero is drinking a Coke. Right. That's exactly the right way to think, so to speak, to say, here is a problem. What are possible solutions that people will come up with? They may come up, almost certainly in the real world, they'll come up with some solutions that you and I never think of. I would never have invented advertising, for example, if I did, starting 100 years earlier or something. And of course, if you look at the web currently is a situation where it is at least inconvenient to sell access. It's not impossible. You can say you've got to log on, you've got to pay something porn sites do, for example. But I'm not sure anybody other than porn sites makes much money out of literally selling the access. But what you do instead is you have ads very often, or you use your site to promote something or other that you can get indirect returns from. Yeah?
What's possible to sell access?
That's right. Because you're right. I guess I was thinking, except what they're selling access to is not the same thing for each customer. That's right. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. And there may be, I don't guarantee there's no exception to what I'm saying. I mean, New York Times, I'm not sure they actually sell access to this. They restrict access in some way. But basically, it's a very convenient technology for giving stuff away, and therefore it makes a lot of sense to figure out, if you want to make money, how you can make money by giving things away, which there are often ways of doing. Other ways, I guess I've already got them in the chapters, you've read them, but one of the points is that one of the things you can do by writing books is to be famous, and one of the things you can do by being famous is to be paid for giving speeches. So that if you look, my guess is that somebody like Bill Clinton or Newt Gingrich can charge an awful lot more than I can for a speech. And I already charge what seems to be an unreasonably large amount of money for the time and effort it takes. So that, in a sense, one of the ways you do the tie-ins is that the stuff you can't easily control, you give in to get yourself a reputation, and then you can turn that reputation into speeches. If you're writing books about financial matters, you can offer advice. If you're writing books about the law, you can be a consultant as a legal scholar, and so forth and so on. And so there are a bunch of indirect, of tie-ins, as it were. There are other ways. Yeah?
I was just going to say, thought of a different way, too, that sometimes people turn their work into something else. So some people that have written songs, I remember, that weren't wildly popular, put them in advertisements. And then people go back and try to find out what song it is.
And also, another point you can do is that if intellectual property in digital form is unprotectable, but intellectual property in a physical object, it's much harder to pirate. So one of the things you do is you have a movie and then you license the toys that have the characters in the movie and the shirts that have the thing about, you know, if I'm going to kill you, I'll do it facing you or something that got somebody in trouble for putting on his door at a college I'm not forgetting the name of the very popular series. In any case, but my point is that you can have tie-ins which are physical objects, and therefore you can prevent piracy much more easily than digital objects that you can't. So those would be other examples. And another thing you can do is straight charity. That is to say, charity in a sense. So you can say, here are my songs, download all you like. If you like them, click this button to transfer 10 cents to me. And if you say, well, look, I'm used to paying $10 or whatever it is for a CD, and this guy writes songs I really like, and he'll give them to me for 10 cents, you may very well say, fine, I think that's a good deal. I will feel I'm a better person, as it were, for having paid for it. So that's another way. It's, I don't know if charity or moral obligation is how you want to put it, but you can think of not sort of directly legal or economic mechanisms by which people pay. And on the one hand, they may not pay very much, but if you think about the fact that when an author writes a book and publishes it, you pay $10 or $20 for the book, and he gets a dollar or two in royalties, so he doesn't have to have that large a royalty in order for that to make sense. One of the publishers who's published one of my books was Bain Books. And Jim Bain was one of the few people in the industry who saw the internet as an opportunity rather than a threat. And so he extensively made books available without any protection. And relied on the fact that partly because having read the book online, you now want a physical copy and you got to pay for that, or having read a free book, you now want the next in the series, which isn't free. So if you want to read a whole lot of not quite up-to-date science fiction and fantasy, you go up on Bain Books Free Library, where they have all of the books that they aren't selling many copies of anymore. And once you get hooked, you then read the next book by the author, which they are selling. So that would be another example of an entrepreneurial. Unfortunately, Jim is no longer alive, so we don't know what will happen, whether the firm will continue to be innovative, but it was for a while. So those are all possible ways of getting paid, and all examples of the general point I'm making, which is that you want to ask not how do you enforce the law, but how do you achieve the objectives. All right, there's another example which I actually discussed in the chapter, but I like it enough I'll discuss it here too, and that's defamation. That in order for defamation law to work, when somebody says something untrue and damaging about me in a way that reaches enough people to matter, I have to have a way of knowing who did it, of taking legal action against him, and of imposing a substantial penalty. That's the basic underlying mechanism of slander and libel law, defamation law. And the problem is that with the current technologies, it is trivial for somebody with almost no resources to be sued to make information available to a large number of people. So that if I can think of something, if you're somebody moderately famous, and I can think of something untrue and damaging to say about you that lots of people want to read, tell lies about you basically, but nice, well-written lies that people who don't like you will believe, I can put up a web page, requires no resources of mine really to do it, put it up for 24 hours. If I'm clever, I can even do it in such a way you never find out who put it up. That at worst, you sue me. What do I have? Nothing. All right? So defamation law doesn't work very well when it no longer requires a newspaper, a printing press, or the equivalent to defame people, when everyone has his own very cheap newspaper. On the other hand, the other solution to defamation is to answer it. That if somebody says a lie about me, I say, that's a lie. Here's the evidence that it's a lie. Not perfect. There are no perfect solutions, but it's a partial solution. And the same technology makes answering much easier because it means that not only a bunch of people who don't like me have heard the lie, I mean, I've heard it too because I asked Google, has anybody said anything about me in the last 24 hours? They said what? All right? So that means that we now have the technology to detect false statements about ourselves and to a significant degree to answer them. Because we can put the stuff up on the web. As I mentioned in the book, my favorite example is Usenet, because on Usenet, Anybody here read Usenet? All right. Usenet, unfortunately, is a declining part of the web. It was a lot of fun. Some of us still use it. But it basically was a huge number of what looked like bulletin boards, each a conversation on some topic, and each having no physical location. That is, it was not a bulletin board on a machine. It was and is a decentralized system where when I make a post to the Usenet server of my ISP, it transmits it to other Usenet servers and it spreads across the world. All right, so a decentralized thing that looks like 100,000 bulletin boards or 10,000 or whatever the number was. And unfortunately, for those of us with a sort of stodgy conservative taste for these old-fashioned institutions such as Usenet, web forums seem to have largely dominated. So we've got these dying conversations where a few people who've been talking with each other for the last 5 years, now there are fewer and fewer and fewer of them. But anyway, Usenet was quite neat while it lasted. And one of the nice things about Usenet was that you could do a search, and that search would tell me if anybody anywhere on Usenet, in any forum on Usenet, had mentioned my name. And once I find they have, if I want to answer it, I can put a post in the same thread on the same forum on Usenet, at which point virtually everybody who read the first statement will read the second. So it's a better targeted system than the web. For the web, I have to somehow count on the fact that the people who have read a slander about me want to know more, and then I have to put my web page rebutting it with enough keywords so that they will come across it when they start looking for more information about what a terrible person I am. All right? Yep. Like what?
Reddit.
I haven't used Reddit. I'm terrible. What's Reddit? I'm old. I'm a dinosaur. I go back 5 years.
This is the same idea that we use forums on this website.
But it's on a website.
It's on a website. So what? How is that distinguished from Usenet? I mean, it's on
a
server.
Oh, no, but Usenet wasn't on a server. Usenet. That's right. Usenet was a decentralized system where I posted to the Usenet server of my ISP, and they then, every time they exchange messages with anybody else's Usenet server, they say, what do you have we don't have, and switch, and it then spreads. So it was a decentralized system rather than a system controlled by any single. So what you're describing is just a web forum. And next year there'll be a different one that's so popular. I haven't really bothered with Facebook because I went up on Google Plus, and I don't use that very much, but I use it a little. But in any case, my real point is not about the relative superiority of those, only that having been involved in one, I naturally like it. Yep.
There were people like someone from the Khan Academy.
Yep. I know what he is. Yeah, he's neat.
He was on there. He had this one format called IAMA. I am so and so, or ask me. I think AMA. Ask me anything.
Yes.
So you verify who you are, and then you do an AMA, and then people ask.
But Reddit, I could put up. Can I put Reddit up on any on my server, or is it a single place?
It's a website. You just sign up.
Right. And but it has threads such that if I find someone mentioning me, I could put a comment in the same thread.
Yeah.
That would work. That would be the same thing. Yeah. And that would have the same. We have the same logic. But for the web in general, it doesn't work, because in the web in general, you can put up a web page on your site slandering me, and I can find it just fine through Google, but I can't get a message onto your server. Right, so therefore I can't put it where I'm sure other people will see it. And that's where I have the suggestion in the book that if we have browsers that show backlinks, if we set it up so that when we're reading your page saying horrible lies about me, anybody who reads it will see there's a link to my page. And then we'll follow that is that I have a link to you, and they will see that as a link going the other way. You see? Right? A backlink browser, which you could do now, or can do now, would be a browser which, when it saw any web page, both showed the links that web page had on it, and in some different symbolism, showed what links to that web page. And that way, if I put something that links to your web page, people who are interested follow the backlink to my web page. So that's the point. The reason I discussed that in the book is that if you did that, one could make a case under copyright law that the backlink browser is infringing the copyright of the web page it's viewing. And the argument would be that it's creating a derivative work, that it's taking your web page, adding the backlinks. And the reason, I haven't kept up with this, so this may be something that got settled in the courts a year ago or 2 years ago, because I don't follow all of these things all the time. But for a while, there was a real controversy over framing. Because you have a web page with some really interesting content in it, news say. I don't want to go to all the trouble of hiring reporters. So I put up a web page which just copies your web page with ads around it. And the question was that a violation of copyright law? And you could certainly argue that it was a derivative work. And so what struck me was that you had this controversy about framing, which was put in terms of that activity, but that the legal outcome to that might affect defamation law. Not defamation law, the substitute for defamation law, by making impossible my particular solution. All right, I thought that was sort of intriguing, the way in which you know, you change something over here and bing, something right over there gets changed. It never even occurred to you. That was why I discussed that issue there, because that's something worth thinking about. It's also fun. It's also interesting. So the argument basically is that it might turn out to be the case with regard to defamation law that instead of trying to try harder and harder to make sure that anybody who lies about me can be sued, for example, by making his ISP liable, which is one way of doing it, but that imposes large costs on the ISP because how do they know what's being put up on web pages they support? That an alternative would be to try to tinker with your legal system and make it as easy as possible to answer things. And then say, all right, you can tell all the lies you like, but 30 seconds after you tell that lie, everybody who hears it will hear the rebuttal. And that's a different approach to the same thing. All right, so those are a couple of examples of the point that technology changes what you can do. That can be convenient. It may make things you want to do easier, but it also makes things you don't want other people to do easier, such as copying your song or your book. A different change, and one which I think is also an interesting one, is that technology messes up the way we think about the world. That is to say, we don't usually realize it, but most of our language and a large part of our thought is done in terms of approximations. That everybody takes it for granted that there is an answer to the question, what's the temperature today? But of course, there isn't an answer to that question because the temperature over there in the shade is a little different from over there in the sun, a little different from over there in a depression of the ground that cold air settles into and so forth. And yet, there's close enough to a temperature out today, so it's useful to put in those terms. All right? Suppose some technological change made differences of a quarter degree Fahrenheit matter. Suddenly, you wouldn't be able to talk anymore about the temperature out there, or at least it would get much more confusing to do so. Let's take some real-world examples, and I will start with the fact that we take it for granted there is such a category as a person or a human being. But is there really such a category? Compare a very retarded human being with a very smart chimpanzee. In exactly what sense is one of them a person and one of them isn't? As you may or may not know, there were a bunch of experiments done 10 or 20 years ago with several different primates, chimps and gorillas, to teach them sign language. And the conjecture, I suspect that it was a mistake. I can go into that later. I'm not sure. But the conjecture was that the other primates, that the reason chimps and gorillas don't talk is not that they're very much stupider than we are. That they're a bit stupider than we are. But the main thing is they have neither the physical apparatus for speaking nor the mental connections for doing speaking, for hearing and understanding language. And so the idea was chimps and gorillas do a lot of stuff with their hands. So maybe if you could teach them sign language, they would turn out to be able to talk just in sign language instead of in human language. And there were some fairly strong claims made by scientists working in this field. My guess is the claims were bogus, and the reason for that is if they had really continued to get results as good as they claimed they were getting, we would all know about it by now, I'm pretty sure. So I think what was happening was that they were not really, that the animals were not really ending up speaking, they were ending up making signs to some extent because they've been taught that you make this sign in this situation, and to some extent randomly making signs, and then the the scientists studied them who wanted to believe in the success of the experiments would only notice the ones that made sense in that situation and say, aha, he's speaking to me. There's a famous example with a gorilla that she's in a boat on the water and there's a duck and she combines the sign for water and bird. Aha, she's thought of the idea duck is a water bird. The only trouble is that if you're in water and you've learned the sign for water, and if you see a bird and you've learned the sign for bird, it isn't all that unlikely that out of a whole bunch of signs, one of them will be the sequence water bird, and if the person who is recording it is someone who really wants to believe that the experiment has been a success, that's the one that gets reported. So as I say, some if you want to, you can read up on this stuff, because I have not followed it. It's just that I'm pretty sure it was a fascinating idea. The idea of being able to talk to animals, really talk to animals. And for a little while, it looked like it might be working, but that was a while ago, and as I said, I would be surprised if it was really working, if it wouldn't be well-known stuff by now. But anyway, but the basic point I'm making is, we aren't going to think of that gorilla as a person. We aren't going to give it legal rights. We're not going to let it sue people. We do think of an insane or severely retarded human being as a person, even though we've got various qualifications to our laws applying to that person, so that we're thinking of the world in a sort of a binary category. Every living creature either is a person or isn't, is a human or isn't. And you can easily imagine technological changes which would make that category less and less useful. That there's a, I don't think I have a chapter in the book, but something that I discussed one of the years in this course and left out this time because I didn't think there was time, was the idea of uplifted animals. This is an idea which a few science fiction writers have played with. Suppose we learn enough about genetics and how the mind works and such that we can modify animals to make them smarter. Suppose we can either use maybe mind drugs or genetic engineering and produce a dog with an IQ of 98. Is that a dog or a person? How will we deal with it? It's not going to fit into any of our categories. All right? It's not going to behave like a human being, because it's still a dog. It's still a different species with a different set of instincts and so forth. And it'll still be a different species if its IQ goes up to 140, and if it's smarter than most of us. So do we treat it as a human being or not? Don't know. But that's going to be a problem for a legal system if that particular science fiction assumption turned out to be the case. To take a different example, and one which is a real example at this very moment, we find it very useful to assume that everybody is either male or female. But as I discussed last time, it isn't true that there have always been occasional hermaphrodites. There are, we now know, a noticeable, though very small, minority of people who have neither the genetics of a male or a female. There are a variety of other genetic patterns that occasionally, more or less by accident, happen. Some of them produce people whose physical characteristics are not quite those. There's one of them is what I referred to as hypermales. There's another one, well, you could go through the list. If you go up on the web, you could find out about these things. But various things in which it isn't entirely clear where they fit in the category. And in addition, the thing which has gotten much more publicity and attention is that there are a substantial number of people who believe that they are the opposite gender they appear to, from the gender they appear to be. People who say, I've always felt I was a woman even though I have a man's body. Or I've always felt I was a man even though I have a woman's body. And I'm sort of naturally skeptical of people, and my first reaction is, I just want people to pay attention to you. But they're willing to go to sufficiently extreme means to correct the mistake, as it were, that I think I believe them. I think they really, in some sense or other, really do feel in their head as though they're the opposite gender. I should say, one such person who I know, because he, she, or it is a moderately famous economist, tells the story that when he went into his department chairman's office to say that he was going to become a she, the department chairman's response was, that's wonderful. We get one fewer man and one fewer woman. We don't have to hire or fire anybody. Say one man, one more woman and one fewer man. Don't hire or fire anybody. So Donald, now Deirdre McCloskey, is now regards herself as a woman, looks like a slightly odd woman, and apparently is much more satisfied with the present state. And there are a fair number, again, a tiny minority, but enough people so that your picture of the world has to include them if you want to make any sense out of it. So all of those are ways in which changes in knowledge, changes all the... Well, suppose we get really good at the surgical operations involved. Suppose we get good enough so that somebody who was born a man and is now a woman is indistinguishable from a woman. If we're really good, can even bear children. That's going to take a while, but it's not absurd. We're learning... I mean, one of the things that's worth realizing is how enormously more we know about biology than we did 100 years ago. That this really is an area. I mean, computers get all the noise, so to speak. But biology and genetics and stuff like that is stuff where progress has been extraordinarily rapid. I offer the following prediction. In 50 years, it will be very unusual for anybody to die of cancer. And the reason is that, as far as I can tell, we are gradually shifting from a very crude approach that nonetheless works a fair fraction of the time, which is basically burning it using chemical drugs and so forth, to actually understanding what's going on. And if you understand what's going on, you then find ways of correcting the genetic defect or of targeting the cells that have the genetic defect that results in this uncontrolled reproduction that we call cancer. And at that point, that problem disappears. All right. So maybe I'm wrong, but I'll put that as a prediction, and you can... If the prediction is wrong, in 50 years, I won't have to worry about you telling me I was wrong. But if the prediction of rapid biological progress is right, maybe I will have to worry about being told that I was right, which is all right with me. It's a great bet. I win it either way, so to speak. Because, of course, at the same time that we're learning to cure cancer, we'll also be learning to cure old age, which is a still more serious disease. So as I'm saying, part of the problem is that the technology, by changing the facts of the world or by changing what we know about the world, means that the categories we've used to talk about things don't work anymore. And those are also the categories we write our laws in. All right? So that our laws do, in fact, distinguish between men and women. I suppose I could claim that we're a couple of thousand years behind the times, because Jewish law several thousand years ago distinguished among men, women, and hermaphrodites. And as far as I know, U.S. law doesn't. All right? It ought to. I mean, there have always been a sprinkling of people who were physically, to some degree, both genders. Greeks knew about it. That's where we get, I think, the term hermaphrodite from. But anyway, the more we know about such complications, the more you get additional complications in the law. Let me take one more example, which I already mentioned last time, but I'll mention it anyway because it's a good example, and that's that we sort of take it for granted that everybody's either alive or dead. But what if you consist of just your head sitting in a container of liquid nitrogen at a temperature at which nothing is going to change for hundreds of years, as long as they can keep you in that liquid nitrogen, and we don't know whether in 40 years we will be able to grow you a new body, put your existing head attached to your new, brand new 20-year-old body, and have you walk out of the surgery a new man, as it were. So are you alive or dead? Don't know. Doesn't fit. Doesn't map into our existing legal system. Or even into our thoughts. Should I be mourning you or not? All right, you were my best friend, and now you're a head sitting in a vat. Should I be saying, oh my gosh, such a terrible thing that a wonderful person died? Or I say, well, I wonder how the world of 2100 will look to him when he gets out. Do I think of you as somebody who is temporarily absent or permanently absent? So those are all examples, I think, of the issue of issues of approximations to the world. Of course, alive and dead is already an approximation, even without cryonic suspension. We've had people in comas. We've had people, you know, there was some, I forget what her name was, some same highly controversial case down in Florida, if I remember correctly, of the question is, do you or don't you turn off, let somebody die when the claim is the brain is no longer active? Is it true? Who knows? You can certainly imagine the case where just before you turn it off, something happens and it turns out the person was alive inside all the time. He could never speak to you, but now it can. God, wouldn't it be a catastrophe if you killed her? On the other hand, your best guess is ain't nobody there, so you might as well stop the life support. So there have always been, and of course there have also been legally ambiguous cases that weren't medical cases. Somebody disappears. Is he dead or alive? And the law has had to deal with that question. You know, if your husband disappears, after how long do you get to marry somebody else without a divorce? As you may know, Benjamin Franklin may have been a bigamist. That is, the right term? Anyway, his wife was somebody whose husband had vanished, but was not known to be dead. So that was an old example of this. So legally, the problem of ambiguity over whether you're alive is not a new problem, but biologically, it may become a more serious new problem. So what do you do with the law when the categories change? And the basic answer is you either map your new categories to the old categories. You say, we will decide that accessing a computer without permission is sort of like breaking into a house, and we'll see how we can fit that legal category, or you invent new law. And those are both possible options. And I guess one of the clearest old examples of this is the copywriting of computer programs. I don't know if it's occurred to you how bizarre it is that copyright law covers computer programs. Because after all, copyright law is supposed to cover writings. Now, I can understand covering the printed source code for a program. But how about the actual machine code burned into the ROMs of a computer somewhere, which no human being can read with his eyes, which human beings with the appropriate equipment can get a printout of, and almost no human beings can read that printout, because the printout consists of saying things like A724 B6G. It's in hexadecimal, I'm assuming, or in some other form. Maybe it's in binary, so it's a whole string of ones and zeros. Can you read that? Very hard. You know, they say there are only two kinds. There are only ten kinds. Kinds of people in the world, those who understand binary and those who don't. Hold you. Anyway, so on the face of it, you could plausibly argue that machine language computer programs are not writings and shouldn't be protected by copyright. And historically, some courts did in fact argue that. When the question originally came up, the courts were divided. One of these was the case with Apple versus Franklin. Franklin made a copy of the Apple II computer, and in order to do that, they had to copy the machine language programs that were built into that computer. Apple sued them for copyright infringement. I don't remember who won that one, but courts were going on both sides of it. And there was a discussion by Hersey, who was a novelist who was at the time, I believe, the head of the Patent and Trademark Office. And he argued that obviously this was not a writing. He was a writer. He knew what a writing was. This was the equivalent of a CAM. People know what a CAM is? A piece of machinery. Take a fancy sewing machine, the kind of sewing machine that will sew embroidery patterns. And how do you do it? You've got this plastic circular disc which goes in here and out here. And that controls how the needle moves. That's a plastic CAM. Normally they were metal and things, but it's for a machine prior to computers. This is in the world before electronic computers, the equivalent of simple robot machinery. You had a physical thing which had in its shape the instructions for how the machine part moved and thus controlled it. All right, and they still exist for, I don't know, maybe by nowadays, maybe the sewing machines have computers too, but at least not too long ago, there were embroidery sewing machines that worked that way. So Hersey said, machine language program is not a writing, it's a CAM. Right, it's controlling a piece of machinery, that's all it's doing. And in fact, there was even a precedent. People know what a player piano is? Player piano was the predecessor of records, CDs, and all the rest. A player piano is a physical piano, which is robot-controlled. They had a tape, a piece of paper, a long, long strip of paper, a roll of paper with holes in it. And there was a pneumatic system that blew air through, and according to where the hole was, that determined which key of the piano was hit down. So you ran through this roll, and the piano played music. Really, a very clever way of doing things if you don't have computers. And there was a case. There was a case in which it was found that the roll of paper for a player piano was not copyrightable because it was not a writing. It was a piece of paper with holes in it. And so Hersey says, perfectly clear, computer programs are not writings. What changed that? Congress. Congress explicitly put into the revision of the copyright code listing computer programs as one of the things protected by copyright. Now, if you were taking my law and econ course, we would spend some time on why I think that was the right answer. But the short answer is that the question you ought to ask is not, is this a writing, but why do we use this kind of legal rule to protect writings? And then my argument would be that the characteristics of writings that made something like copyright law appropriate were also characteristics shared by computer programs, even though computer programs obviously are not writings, except for the source code. People know about source code and object code. I don't know how many of you people have actually written computer programs and things, but the source code is what the human being writes, which a program then translates into a form a computer can read. That's a very short version of it. And so I would say that under old copyright law, copying the object code, the stuff the computer reads, should not have counted as a violation of copyright law, although copying the source code should. So that's an example where, in fact, you were arguing about whether or not to read old law into new law. And you still have problems. I don't know how many of you have actually followed sort of modern copyright law on computer programs. It's quite unclear what's protected, because a computer program is not a writing. It's well established that if you write a novel which has a chapter that's a verbatim copy of my novel, you violated my copyright. And it's quite well established that if your novel has a copy of my plot, you are not violating my copyright law. All right? My copyright. It's not clear what the equivalent of that is for software. And there's been litigation ever since, more or less, on just what is or isn't covered. So if I take your program and rewrite it in a different computer language, is that a violation of your copyright? If I copy your interface, do people know about the question, what was the name? It was Borland versus Lotus v. Borland. Do you know about Lotus v. Borland? Spreadsheet. All right, spreadsheet was one of the great clever ideas of computer programs. So the Lotus had the dominant spreadsheet. And Lotus had a set of commands, of keyboard commands. This was before people were making much use of menus and stuff. Of keyboard commands to tell the program save, add, do whatever things it was doing. And so Borland wrote their own spreadsheet. And they copied nothing from Lotus. They wrote the thing on basically on a blank sheet of paper, their own computer program to do the same things. But they wanted it to be easy for people who knew how to use Lotus 1-2-3 to learn how to use the Borland program. And what's the obvious way to do that? You use the same key commands. So the same combination of keys, save, the same combination of keys, do this, the same combination of keys, bring up a menu with some more keys on it that you press one and so forth. And Lotus sued. And if I remember correctly, when that got to the Supreme Court, it was a 4-4 squit. So I still don't think we really know what the law is. But the question was that a copyright violation? And you could plausibly enough argue, no, it wasn't a copyright violation. It was a patent violation, though. There's not much originality to S for save. But in any case, that's not a problem that would have happened with a real writing. So that sort of demonstrates that when Congress decides the solution to the problem protecting computer programs is to pretend they're writings, that solves some problem and raises others. Yes?
Didn't it eventually just decide that it did not extend to the text or code? I have
you may have later information than I do.
In my IT class, yes.
It is now held that it is not a violation.
Yeah, it's too inconvenient to force the code changing.
Well, not the code changing, but yeah. The
program keys and the short keys.
Yes, right. Yeah. Good. I think that's a good decision. But, yeah. No, I was last teaching an IP law course 20 years ago or something, so I do not claim to be up to date or anything close to up to date on that. But as you may have gathered, I'm really not very interested in what's happening this year. That I'm really interested in what we can guess about what's happening for the next 30 or 40 years, and what's happening this year is interesting only to the extent that it points us at interesting questions or possible answers or whatever. Right? But, yes, thank you. So let me go on to what's going to be I guess I mentioned before the issue of the child with five parents, and that's sort of one subset of the issues that we're going to be getting as we have more and more ability to play with the genetics of reproduction. Take the obvious question, suppose somebody clones me. All right. As I assume all of you know, contrary to the popular image, cloning me does not mean you get somebody else who looks just like me with gray hair and halfway through writing my books. It means you get a baby who is my identical twin. All right. But suppose they do that. Whose child is that baby? Well, suppose we did genetic testing. We've got paternity testing. Who do you find out is the father of that baby when you do paternity testing? My father, of course. That's right. A little unfair to him. He's not alive anyway, but if he were, I mean, I don't think he could claim much responsibility for it. Right, my father is the father, and if we use genetic testing instead of the old legal rule, my mother, mother would be my mother. One of the interesting questions is, suppose somebody successfully gets a little bit of tissue from Mr. Buffett, for example, and the technology have progressed a little bit, they turn that tissue into an infant. Can they then plausibly claim child support for that infant from Mr. Buffett? Warren Buffett, at a level appropriate to his income, could be a very nice job being the mother of that child. All right, so how is law going to treat it? And in fact, oddly enough, although we don't have cloning, there is one very bizarre case that I don't remember if one of my students pointed out to me or what, where a woman, a nurse, has, I think, oral sex with a man using a condom, uses that to get the sperm, uses that to impregnate herself, has a baby, and sues for child support. All right. Well, that's the closest with old-fashioned technology for doing it. But it does raise the same kind of issue that we can normally take it for granted that the process that produces a baby at some point involved consent by both parties. Well, maybe not anymore. Given that kind of thing. Or how about we take it even further? Suppose that I get a full genetic mapping. We don't have it yet, but it looks as though in the not very distant future, you're going to be able to get a full map of your genome. And security isn't as good as it might be, and somebody managed to get a copy of the map of my genome. And biology having regressed a little bit, with a copy of the map of my genome, they can reconstruct the cell. And I then discover I have a child who I never had any connection with, who was created using synthetic sperm made with a synthetic copy of my genes. All right? Can't do it yet. Well, 20 years, maybe. Not impossible. The point really are the potential complications for our ways of looking at the world and regulating it by the law that come from new technologies. Let me go on to what is maybe the most interesting of the ones that could easily happen, and that's artificial intelligence. All right? We don't know. I don't know what I am. You don't know what you are. I feel like I have a consciousness looking out of my eyes. All right? That's how we all feel. And there's sort of this old idea of the immortal soul and all the rest of it. But as far as I can tell, the closest thing to a model for what I am is a computer program. That if you are used to what computer programs do, it sort of looks like what a person is. It's just a really sophisticated, fancy computer program running on the hardware of my brain. Might turn out it's not true. We don't know. Suppose it is true. Let us suppose, not implausibly, that if we only knew enough, we could figure out what each of us was. Well, if we can do that, the non-biological hardware we have available is getting better and better and better. So presumably, if we understand how the mind works considered as a computer, we can build computers like that. And when they get fast enough and have enough memory, they'll be about as smart as we are. All right? That's the artificial intelligence sweepstakes, so to speak, to be able to create a programmed computer which is about as smart as we are. And that raises two different issues. The first one, which seems pretty easy, is, are they people? Yeah, they're people. I just had a conversation with one yesterday, right? That you could certainly imagine an artificial intelligence sufficiently convincing that you believe it's really a person. The traditional test that somebody suggested a long time ago is if you have an AI and a human being and another human being talking to them via some communication channels where you can't see, can you tell them apart? If a human being can't prove that he's a human being and not an AI, that's as good evidence as we can reasonably hope to have that the AI is really a person, that the AI can do an adequate job of pretending to be a person to other people. So suppose we've got AIs that pass the Turing test, which is what that's called, and suppose we decide, yes, indeed, they're people. how then do we fit these very, very different people into our legal system? For example, to begin with, that AI came into existence on a piece of hardware. That hardware belongs to somebody. Does he belong to somebody? Is the human-level program running on the $6 million computer that which I finally succeeded in making that program work? Is that my slave? Does it belong to me? Did I just lose my $6 million computer because now it's part of him? How about if I want to turn it off to try to develop another AI? Have I just committed murder? So if you try to imagine, of course it gets much worse than that, because one of the things we know about computer programs is they're really easy to copy. So someone else has a $6 million computer, and we make a second copy of the program. Well, before we did that, the first copy wrote a novel, and it sold very well, and so the first copy has a healthy bank account. Does the second copy get half the bank account? How do we decide which is which? Just by the history of which machine, which one was run? Same program. All right. So if you take seriously the possibility of artificial intelligence, you then start thinking of a lot of different puzzles about how you would fit an existing legal system designed for biological human beings into a world where many of the human beings were cybernetic rather than biological. All right. That's one set of potential issues. And of course, it doesn't stop there, because there's something else we can do after we figure out how the human mind works. We can not only use that information to design a computer, I can also use that information to back myself up. All right? If I really understood how the mind works, and if we've got a sufficiently powerful computer, I just make an exact copy of the present state of my mind onto that computer, and now there's two of me. One of them, you know, looking out through LCD stuff, sitting on my desk, and one of them inside my head, and he's just as much me as I am. I mean, we're exact metal copies. Does he have a claim to half my property? Can he be made to testify against me? How about when we make some more copies? How about when you kill me and somebody says, well, he's not really dead. Look, I mean, there he is right there. And furthermore, if we've got good biology, we'll grow a new body. We'll make another copy from the computer back to the newly grown body. And there he is alive and kicking. How can you say he was dead? All right. So I guess all I'm trying to suggest is that as the technology expands the range of things we can do, there are all sorts of potential ways in which it complicates the legal rules that we use for doing them. Let's see if I can sum up. I guess one part of the summary of what I'm saying I already said at the beginning of this, which is that the question to ask is not how do you keep doing what you're doing, but how do you best achieve the objectives of what you're doing. But the other half is that almost everybody is way too conservative in his view of the future. This is why, as I think I said before, when I gave a talk on my book at Google, I started out by saying that global warming was a pretty wimpy catastrophe. Because it might be inconvenient to have the temperature of the world 3 degrees higher. It might be inconvenient to have sea level a few feet higher. But, you know, compared to what happens if we get human level artificial intelligence in 30 years, and 10 years later those artificial intelligences have raised their IQ by a factor of 10 and decide they don't like us, that's a real catastrophe, all right? Compared to that, global warming is pretty tiny. That if we get human-level AI, there's no reason to expect the AI to stop at human level, and that could be a very nice world. We could have a world where we finally got a god, right? You know, that's an old science fiction story. Back before there were many computers, somebody has done this. The finest computer ever built, the most intelligent, the most et cetera, et cetera. And so they ask it the question that no computer before could ever answer, is there a God? And it answers, now there is. So maybe high-level AI will mean benevolent superiors taking good care of us. We'll be pets, but we can be happy pets at least. Maybe, as Kurzweil suggests, in the process of learning to make super intelligent computers, we will also learn how to link our minds to computers and make super intelligent uses, because we'll be doing most of our thinking in silicon. So one of those is a catastrophe if the computers decide to replace us. One of them would be wonderful. We all become super geniuses. Won't that be fun? And both of those are possible. And similarly, one can easily enough imagine nanotech or biotech solving aging, giving us a world where everybody is healthy and young. I'm in favor of that. I've gotten to the point where I wouldn't mind being a little bit younger. And mind even less knowing that I was going to stay that way for the next few hundred years. I've got projects I'd like to finish. And I'd like to see how my fruit trees cut out. I added three of them yesterday. So things could get a whole lot better or a whole lot worse, and almost certainly are going to get a whole lot different. I guess that sort of is the bottom line. And I think people don't appreciate how fast things change. That, let me take as, in a way, symbolic of it, one of the particularly bizarre bizarre blunders by a politician in recent years. That there have been a number of cases. Actually, my most recent blog post was about just how historically ignorant various political figures appeared to be. But one of them is our current vice president, who, as you may remember, at one point during the campaign commented that when the stock market crashed, FDR went on television to tell the American people something or other. Now, it turns out that television, for all practical purposes, did not exist in 1929, and FDR was not president in 1929, both of which facts somehow seem to have vanished from Biden's mind. But I think, in a sense, and well, you know, I don't mind making fun of Biden, I don't particularly like him, but the more serious point is that most of us aren't really adjusted to the fact that recently there weren't any televisions, or maybe there were televisions in experimental labs, basically, but for practical purposes there are no televisions. We think of AIDS as a plague. Measles was killing more people in 1900 relative to the population than AIDS kills now. Tuberculosis and influenza were killing enormously more people than AIDS is killing now. Again, relative, probably literally more, but certainly relative to the population more. We've gone from a world. There's a book called, I don't know what it's called, The Youngest Science, which is by a physician and hospital administrator whose father was a doctor, and so who has sort of two generations worth of watching medicine. And he comments that when his father was trained, in most cases, all a competent doctor could do was predict. He couldn't cure things. All a competent doctor could do was to say, here is what you have, you'll probably be better in a week, or here is what you have, you better make your will. Now, there were a few exceptions. They could set bones, they could deal with vitamin deficiency diseases, they had ways of dealing with some diseases, some of which did almost as much damage as the disease, but mostly they couldn't cure stuff. And then in the 1920s, I think, the first sulfa drugs, which were the precursors of the modern things like penicillin, start coming out. And it was just amazing. I mean, the guy who wrote the book saw it. He was, I think, a young medical student or something at the time. And doctors had been quacks for 2,000 years, and suddenly they were doing what they'd been pretending to do. They were curing people who had serious diseases, which they, again, with a few rare exceptions, just hadn't been able to do before. So it's less than 100 years since doctors learned to cure disease. That's a slight rhetorical exaggeration, but not a very large one. All right? So if you have a very old grandparent, that grandparent was born at a time when almost all diseases were incurable. That gives you some feeling for the rate of progress that we've had. And one part of the reason why my guess is that the remaining ones, of which cancer is certainly one of the most serious ones, are going to fall eventually. I don't know quite how soon, but in time. So, but there have been other changes as well. If you think about the difference between a world where transportation was horse-drawn wagon and a world where it's automobiles routinely and jet planes when you're in a hurry and want to go very far, from a world where long-distance communications, they had this wonderful new invention, the transatlantic cable, which at an enormous cost lays essentially a telephone line across the Atlantic, and finally we can get messages, not like everybody talking to everybody. I mean, you don't expect 100 conversations on one poor cable, but at least we can get some information across quickly. And now, you know, you have a conversation with somebody in Japan, you don't even know he's in Japan, right? If you're engaged in internet interactions very often. So there's been a very, very rapid change in our own lifetimes, and the result is that it's going to be a very interesting century. and I hope you all enjoy it. And you might want to start reading some of the stuff on strong privacy, because I think I've really finished the preliminaries. This, in a sense, this course gets out of sync at the very beginning, because we start on a Monday, and I want to spend some time talking about preliminaries, but I ought to, this ought to have been a Monday lecture so that I could start on the next technology on the Wednesday, and instead I think I'll just spend both a Monday and a Wednesday doing the Wednesday's work on lots of stuff on encryption and everything related.